Embroidery artist Helen Stevens is our guest this week, and the show is sponsored by the Embroiderers Guild of America and Sassy Jack Stitchery. The EGA is extremely active throughout the U.S., offering needle art information and stitching opportunities at all levels and with all techniques. If you're curious about the organization and want to know more, join or follow the EGA on Facebook and or on Instagram, or visit the website at egausa.org. You don't have to be a member to enjoy a lot of what the EGA has to offer, a little exploration, and I'm sure you'll be tempted to join. Be sure to note that the 2023 National Seminar Boston Stitch Party, organized by the New England region, will be held September 1 to 5 in Boston. Class registration begins March 11 at noon Eastern, and you can sign up at egausa.org for a reminder. Also, check out the new online class, Embroidered Sequin Butterfly Card, with Connie Chow, in which you make two butterfly sequin greeting cards. Registration starts December 7. Join the EGA today at egausa.org. It will open new stitching doors for you. Also sponsoring this week's show is Sassy Jack Stitchery. Kim and the folks at Sassy Jack's are starting to move inventory from Kim's basement to the new store, and it's looking like the long-awaited grand opening will happen in early 2023. In the meantime, be sure to check out sassyjackstitchery.com for the full collection of sassafras samplers charts. Kim and company are also now carrying the beautiful Cottage Garden threads, new designs from Ink Circles, including the Victorian Licensed Cosmo Kit, and are restarting the Cosmo Thread Club. When you're doing your holiday shopping, a great gift for your stitching friends is a Sassy Jack's gift certificate. Make Sassy Jack Stitchery your local needlework store by visiting the website at sassyjackstitchery.com. Now let's enjoy our conversation with the incredible embroidery designer, Helen Stevens. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week, Helen Stevens from Helen Stevens True Embroideries. Helen, welcome.
Hi. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's great to be with you.
Now, the first time, I'm sure I've seen your work before, or had seen your work before, but the first time that I really became aware of you was the Inspirations magazine, the Flowers of the Sea design.
Oh, yes. Yep. That was a few years ago now. But yes, I've been working with Inspirations almost 20 years now, off and on. And in fact, oddly, earlier on today, I was talking with the editor about us doing some project to actually celebrate the fact that the 20 years anniversary is coming up in due course.
Yep, you need to celebrate that. Well, I'll tell you why this one stood out. Before we did Fiber Talk, I did a podcast. I used to keep marine aquariums and grow coral. And we had a podcast where we talked about all that hobby. And when I look at needlework, and people would try to do ocean things, you know, reef, marine things, they always just looked cartoony and just didn't work. And when this one popped up in Inspirations magazine, I just stopped cold. I remember the moment very clearly, because you absolutely captured with needle and thread as much realism as I think is possible for marine life. And it was just... it still is. I mean, that one's set aside. That's on my bucket list, I guess, to do, because that it's just a standout piece. Really good. Yep.
Well, it's lovely of you to say so. I remember working it well, actually, and it was a challenge, because whilst I think underwater subjects can lend themselves very well to embroidery, as you say, it's quite difficult to get a realistic effect. It is a little bit touch and go as to whether it's easy to go over the top. I think that's what I'm trying to say.
Yes. Well, and see, the other thing that I had in my head is I, while keeping marine aquariums, got rather accomplished at photographing coral up close, macro, up close, that kind of thing, photographing in aquariums. And when I did business trips, I would connect with marine aquarists all over the country and go to their homes and photograph their coral. And when I saw that, it was, you know, clearly you had done your research, because the realism there is really extremely good, particularly for needle and thread. No, I just really applaud you on that one. It's just well done. Yeah.
I think in all of my subject matter, and of course, I would say the majority of my contemporary work is to do with natural history in one shape or form. You do have to know your subject. You have to do your research and sort of understand how either the plant grows or the animal works, so to speak. You know, the anatomy of the animal, the anatomy of the plant. You have to know what's going on underneath to really recreate it, I think, in any medium, and embroidery is no different.
Yeah. Well, you kind of keep a small zoo there at the house. What orients you toward nature pieces? Is it just a love of nature, or?
Yeah, I've always been, for the want of a better word, an animal nut. I love animals. I love all animals. But while I was doing a lot of traveling to teach and lecture and that sort of thing, I'd often be away, you know, say 5 weeks at a time doing an Australian tour or a Canadian tour or something like that. I only had a cat because my beautiful cat, who I hated to leave, was very happy in a cattery. So I knew I could leave him there and he would be perfectly safe. But then I took the decision a few years ago that I'd really had enough of traveling with the world the way it is at the moment. There's not a lot of pleasure in the actual process of traveling. So I found myself with the ability to build up an animal family. And the first edition was the poodle, Mitty, a little black toy poodle, which was something I had always wanted. Of course, my original pussycat had passed away by then. So Mitty was, in fact, in solitary splendor to begin with. Next came my cat that I have now, who's special needs. He was a rescue cat. He suffers from a condition which limits his ability to walk and run. But he doesn't realize he's special. Then I had two rescue chinchillas. They again were rescue. A parrot who needed a good home. And most recently, two special needs budgies.
So you have quite the menagerie there.
Yeah. I like to think I'm giving all of them the best lives they can possibly have.
Mm-hmm. Special mm-hmm. needs parrots and cat. Yeah, you can't just have normal animals. Got to have a
no. I'm an embroiderer. You know, we don't do normal.
I got to know, because I've always wanted to own a parrot. I'm just not sure I can commit to the longevity. What flavor parrot do you have?
Oh, he's a conure. He's a fairly small fellow. With a following wind, they go on about 30, 35 years. So it's not one of these sort of 90-year-old issues. But, he's a very pretty. He's green and yellow and pink. And you may well hear him squawking in the background at some stage.
Okay, well, we'll take that. We're quite used to Best Cat joining in the podcast, so not a problem.
Oh,
nice. Right. He's sitting here. He's very happy. He's sitting on a blanket in the sun. He knows I'm here, so he's happy. So
that's it. Yeah, that's the way it goes.
So how does embroidery enter your life?
Well, when I was a child, my father was in the RAF, and in fact, we were in the States for 3 years during the 60s. And I remember very distinctly, I was quite a small child being bored one day, not knowing, you know, what to do with myself. I think it was during a move. And my dad, actually, from somewhere, found a great big sort of skein of tangled wool, and he showed me how to make it into a beautiful round ball, which I think was something he'd learnt from his mum. And really, from that moment, I think, thread just fascinated me. So beginning, obviously, from just handling the thread when I was very small, I then found that of the many disciplines that one can go towards when one's working in textiles, it was embroidery or work with a needle to decorate something that appealed to me. I started out, like I suppose a lot of youngsters do, with the little kits that you could and still can buy. But it wasn't very long before I realised that I could actually make my own designs, from sketching. Although in later years, I never had an art training. I haven't had an art training or indeed a textile training. Everything has come to me without actual qualifications.
One of those people. I'm so jealous that it's just in the genes. Yeah,
it's just in the genes. Yeah, and so I started creating my own, but it was still just very much a hobby. All the time I was going through school, it kind of never really occurred to me or my parents that I could make a life out of it. When I left school, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I took a secretarial training. I was a secretary for 5 years, and then I just could not stand doing the 9-to-5 anymore. And the only other thing I was good at was embroidery. So basically, with the confidence that you only have when you're in your early 20s, I just gave up the day job and said, right, this is what I'm going to do now. And I did it.
So you didn't have any art training?
No, I did what in the UK in those days we called O-level art, which is just sort of the very base that you take the O-level exam, I think at like 14. But, I never took it seriously. It was something, and when I did decide to give up the day job, you can probably hear the parrot in the background. Yep. Now. When I did give up the day job and decided to be an embroideress full time, I at least had a background of working in business, so that I was able to run my studio, run my business under my own steam. I think a lot of people, perhaps if they've been to university, got a degree in art or in textile or whatever, they come out the other end with knowledge of that, but without a knowledge of how the actual world works, the big bad world of business. And I've never regretted having that secretarial and office experience, because it set me in very good stead from the beginning.
Yeah, I think that that particular situation has been the demise of many needlework businesses, where you take that hobby and you say, hey, I could make money at it, and I could make this my business and give up the job. But it's the inability to do the business side that just trips too many people up. Yeah,
you're so right, Gary. And of course, also, we're talking about 1981. That sounds a scary length of time ago, and it is. And I was very young, and I was determined to work art embroidery, as opposed to going down what would have been actually an easier route to apply embroidery in a sort of craft medium. Everybody always wants cushion covers and, that kind of thing. But I was determined that it was going to be art, full stop, something that you hung on your wall, something you looked at. And of course, also back in the 80s, certainly here in the UK, and I suspect therefore in other parts of the world, embroidery, what I call real embroidery, embroidery with a needle and a thread and a piece of fabric and a hoop, probably, was very much in the doldrums. There was a lot of applique work. There was a lot of sort of artificial fibers, artificial things being used. In fact, you know, you could see what was called a piece of embroidery, and it didn't actually have any stitches in it. You know, it was very sort of outlandish. Yeah. The traditional values of embroidery had sort of been bastardized, I think. It was probably a reaction, you know, in all forms of history, things swing one way and then the other. And just at that time, the pendulum had swung very, very far away from traditional techniques and realistic techniques, and even the use of silk. It was very difficult to actually find real silk to work with. But I had a very lucky break with that. But that's another story.
Well, that's so. You took absolutely the most difficult path. Then how did you see? You obviously saw a path to or a way to have an income. But that's you talk about young and fearless. Yeah,
ridiculously so. I could see that there was nothing on the market and no specific artist that I was aware of that was working the type of work that I was beginning to make my speciality, which was the realistic depiction of nature. I mean, I've done other subjects as well, but that's what I always seem to come back to. I remember, you know, very early on in my career, again, the arrogance of youth, I used to say, you know, well, if you can paint something, you can embroider it. You know, it's not going to look like a painting and it's not going to look like a photograph, but, you know, it doesn't intend to be. It's an embroidery, and embroidery in itself has its own charms, you know. So I would never be daunted in those days. In fact, I don't think I still am by any subject matter, even if it wasn't natural history. I remember because when I first started, well, still to a large extent, major pieces of work were commissioned by a client. So they would ask me to embroider a subject that, you know, they loved, that they wanted a picture of. And I would say yes, basically. And I, apart from the things that you would expect, like, you know, flowers and animals and birds and butterflies, I would have somebody come along and say, can you do me a railway engine, you know, a steam engine, or can you do me a sports car? Or and I would just say yes. With at that moment when I said yes, absolutely no idea how I was going to do it, but just certain that I could, you know, because I had faith in the needle, you know. You really can depict anything. Some things obviously lend themselves better to embroidery than other things. Again, depending on how realistic you want your finished piece to be. I mean, if you're going into the abstract or the impressionistic, you know, you can get away with murder, so to speak. But if you really want to try and capture realism, as I was saying before, you have to understand your subject. And so I suppose I specialized in that which I loved, because I was curious about it. I wanted to understand it. I liked doing the research. And so natural history was natural.
Yeah.
So do you do a lot of sketches before you start a piece?
What I tend to do, if it's a commission, if somebody, for instance, you know, comes along and says, I absolutely love red foxes, I would like a study of a red fox, and oh, yes, my favourite flower is this, and could you have him peeping out of the long grasses? You know, that's a picture they've got in their mind. They've seen my work, they know they like my work, and they know that's a subject they'd like, and then they will leave it to me to come up with a finished, what I call cartoon, which is just a basic, a very basic idea, an outline of what I'm going to do. I would show them that, and 99.9 times out of 100 people will say, yes, that's gorgeous, love it, you know. And then it's at that stage that I will begin, if you like, to bring it to life by, you know, obviously starting to get the textures and the colours in. So I would, as I say, at the cartoon stage, do it from sketches and then fine it up before I actually create my pattern that I'm going to transfer onto my background fabric. And then the fine details I don't transfer. I do most of that freehand because any line that you transfer onto your background fabric may well be a thicker line than the detail that you're actually trying to achieve. So obviously that's going to defeat the object. So a lot of the very fine details do go on freehand.
Yeah. It's so interesting to hear you tell this story, because Beth and I have had dozens of conversations about how, as young people, we have that fearlessness and that ability to ask the question, what if, and then pursue it. And it gets beaten out of us over the years, just as we mature. And I've always kind of felt that good artists are able to cling to that. Never give it up.
They are. Yeah, I think also, you know, it's helpful, let's put it that way, if you have someone who believes in you, who gives you good advice and doesn't try to discourage you. My dad, bless him, who is sadly has not been with us for a long while now, he gave me a bit of advice when I really first started out, which I have since passed on to a lot of people. You know, who are starting a business, in particular, obviously in the textile side of things. But he knew that it was going to be a hard line to follow. But this was his advice. He said, you've got to give yourself 3 years before you really know whether you think you can make a success of this. He says, at the end of the first year, you've got to look down the tunnel. And if you see just a spot of light at the end of the tunnel, you keep going towards that spot. And at the end of the second year, you ought to be able to see the arch at the end of the tunnel with the light coming in, and you keep going towards that arch. And he said, at the end of the third year, you ought to be able to walk out through the end of the tunnel into the sunlight. And I've always remembered that, and I've always passed it on. And it's a great piece of advice for anybody who's starting up something that is, you know, really different and where it is going to be a battle to get people to take you seriously, even.
Yeah. Oh, that's terrific. Yeah.
That is great advice. Yeah. Because then you can, you know, I think people do, they see the little light after the first year, and they're like, okay, I'm giving up. It's just, they don't just give it enough time.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And you know, I mean, I won't lie, during the first year, maybe a little longer than that, I was creating pieces of work which people loved, they liked them. And they were obviously different to anything that anybody else was creating. But I did not charge the prices for them that was really sensible, given the amount of hours that those pieces had taken. I mean, especially then, I didn't sew as quickly then as I do now, 40 years later. But, you know, probably I would have made more money going out scrubbing floors than I was actually making per hour stitching.
Yeah.
But, you know, Rome wasn't built in a day. You've got to, you know, get the hard yakka in before you can expect to start getting, you know, the accolades in. And so, you know, that's what I did. And I couldn't afford either advertising. I've hardly ever actually advertised anything that I've done or events that I've been taking part in because I couldn't afford it. Especially in those early days, it was way beyond anything I could afford. But I've always believed that, you know, a few lines of editorial in a magazine or a newspaper or whatever was worth half a page of paid advertisement because people read editorial and it sinks in and they take it seriously. Whereas, you know, you can say anything you like in an advertisement, but, you know. And so, again, I guess because I had the business training, I knew, you know, how to get myself noticed by, you know, writers and as I say, magazines. And, you know, they would write an article about me of several pages, which would have been an absolute fortune in advertising. But. You know, was just so valuable to me. And one of those articles back in the early 90s was in a magazine in the UK called Woman and Home. And it was a super article feature, lots of pictures of my work. And after that article was published, I was actually approached by three different publishers who were interested in commissioning me to write a book. And I chose the best, which turned out to be David and Charles, who a lot of your listeners, they'll know that publishing house. And I stayed with them, you know, for many, many years. 12 books later, you know, they still look after all my needlework publishing, or they have done, you know, up until now.
Yeah. Wow. And that's, you know, Beth actually has a friend who has, sounds like, the entire collection, and Beth's been perusing your books, and
now
I have to buy some.
Yeah. I might have to add one to my library. And I don't think my friend would appreciate if I just said, "Oh, what do you mean you loaned me that book?" But they're well done. They're beautiful. She has the hardcover copies. I don't know if they come in soft cover or
not. I think, I mean, as I say, my first book, my first big book was I think it was 1992. That is The Embroiderer's Countryside, and came out in several editions, including a later one, which we called the Masterclass Edition, which has actually got projects in it for people to work. And that one is now, because obviously it went out of print for a while, being that long ago, but that one is now available. You know, back in print, so to speak. But for quite a few of my other ones, which aren't, you know, just in print at the moment, they're not difficult to find these days on Amazon and eBay and that sort of thing. It's the great thing with those particular platforms, you know, that it is much easier these days to find books which are no longer on the bookshelves than it used to be.
Yeah.
Right. Well, they're just so well done. And I was perusing them and looking at the detail in them. The photos are gorgeous. And then you show sketches like, okay, this is my sketch. This is what I stitched. It just helps if, like, I think if you wanted to do your own design, even using your method, it would be a great jumping off point for people.
Yeah, that was very much what I wanted to do. You know, make the give other people the confidence to work their own interpretation of things, rather than always giving them, you know, an exact design, a template, so to speak. And I've kept that going now throughout kind of all my classes. I used to encourage people to do that. And now that I have an online presence and I do downloadable designs. Again, I always emphasize this. I always say, you know, well, nothing here is set in stone. Interpret it in your own way. You know, I never say that anything is wrong. I just say it's different. and you know, if people want to swap around the elements in the different pictures, they can do that. You know, they can make it their own. It doesn't have to be exactly the same as the way I worked it.
In one of the writings, I think it was the author description in the UK Amazon, you say that you struggle to decide whether you're a writer or a needle artist, and that the books give you an outlet. Obviously you enjoy doing books, I mean, because that's a lot of work.
Yes, it is a lot of work. I mean, the big books that I was writing for David and Charles, there's a lot of words in there. I'm trying to remember how many they are. I think it's 75,000 or something like that in those big books. But yeah, I mean, I do love writing. I love language. In fact, when I was at school, really, it was always English and history that were my two great loves. I mean, I didn't even think about art in those days. But English, and as I say, history, were always my two great loves. And, yes, I loved writing. I always did. And you know, I always wanted to write books. And so when I was contacted, after that article I told you about, you know, they were sort of diffidently saying, well, have you ever thought about doing a book? And, it wasn't, I didn't quite like to tell them, yes, I hardly ever think about anything else, but I think, all credit to David and Charles, who was the ones that I eventually picked to go with, because my first book, The Embroiderer's Countryside, when it was written, was so totally different from any other embroidery books that were out there. I said I wanted to write an embroidery book, not just for embroiderers. And after it was published, I got feedback to say, yeah, that was exactly what, you know, we had achieved, because many people, you know, bought it, enjoyed it for its illustrations, and also enjoyed reading it, because what I tried to do was make it available, so to speak, to other people to read, and kind of hide away a lot of the technical stuff in a sort of sneaky way, so that you hardly realized you were reading it until after you'd read it, and then you were back to things which would interest not just embroiderers, because I would give a lot of the history about the subject that I was dealing with, and history about the stitches themselves, and, you know, the interaction between the two. And I know one shouldn't have favorite books in the way one shouldn't have favorite children, but my possibly favorite book that I've ever written on embroidery was certainly The Myth and Magic of Embroidery, because, you know, the stories, the legends, the way in which embroidery in so many cultures has sort of suffused the culture itself, and also the imagery, the religion. It's just fascinating. The folklore, you know, it's endless amounts of folklore that involves stitching and embroidery, and especially, you know, in Northern Europe, where the pagan gods, you know, they identified so much with embroidery. It's fascinating study.
All right, you just cost me a bunch of money, because that's what I got to buy some of your books, because that's, to me, what puts some books on a different level, is because anybody can do a project book. You know, here's a project, here's a list of materials, here's a pattern, go execute it. But to add that extra dimension, that background, that depth, is, to me, what really makes a book worth owning. And the same for magazines. I mean, I think that's the strength of Inspirations magazine. is that there's more there than just patterns.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, the way they present the patterns and the photography of the embroideries themselves is just outstanding. You know, it's so beautiful. As you say, it's not just a full square image. It's just everything is beautifully thought out. And there's stuff to read there, as you so rightly say, that is not just about, as I used to say when I was teaching, it's not just about this is where you put the needle in and this is where you take it out. There's more to it than that.
Yeah, and to me that, you know, even if you're doing the project, it adds that extra level of meaning that makes it so much more enjoyable. Yeah.
Absolutely.
All right,
yeah.
Left turn. Tell us about the Saxon twins.
Ah, the Saxon twins. Yes, well, as I think I said, history has always been very foremost in my mind as well. And the Anglo-Saxon period, of course, was once again, as practically all your listeners will know, I'm sure, in England, embroidery was a very important part of the culture. It was considered foremost amongst the arts. And wherever you were in the then known world, if you wanted to commission the very best embroidery, you commissioned it from England. Hence why it was called Opus Anglicanum, simply English work. You know, that just described embroidery. The best embroidery was English work. In various roundabout ways, the concept of Anglo-Saxon life and Anglo-Saxon embroidery interested me, and having read about it, as I said, anything to do with, you know, myth, magic, excitement, romance, it all kind of came together when I learned about a certain character who was called Brithnoth, who was an earl, an ealdorman, as the Anglo-Saxon tongue would have put it, in the east of England, not far in fact from where I live. And his wife was a famously brilliant embroideress. Well, this just interested me straight away, and I started researching his story. Which was fascinating. Basically, just had everything you needed for a blockbuster. You know, it had battles, it had murder, it had love. It even had people sort of trying to practice witchcraft. And, you know, it was Tolkien for embroiderers, let's put it that way.
Yeah, you just checked all the boxes there. Yep.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Game of Thrones, no, Game of Needles, you know. and so I researched these characters, and the cast of characters just kept expanding. The connection, oddly, to embroidery also expanded within the factual evidence that I found. But of course, the Anglo-Saxon period and the part of it that we're talking about here, which is kind of the turn of the 9th and the 10th centuries, is over 1,000 years ago. So, of course, you know, the whole of history in that period is scattered with might have beens and what could have happened. And, you know, there's an awful lot that we don't know, although the framework is there. Obviously, the details aren't very often. So basically, I thought, well, I think I'm going to take a few liberties here and create a few extra characters to, you know, link the whole thing together. And so the idea of the Saxon twins was born. The twins themselves, one of whom is an embroideress, although she gets up to many other things as well. The other is a fighter, a soldier. And it really is a story that has just about everything in it, to tell the truth.
Yeah. Okay. I got to read that too. Okay.
Yeah, you got to read that too. unfortunately for me, of course, we were due to publish just exactly, I mean, to the week when the pandemic hit, so to speak. Oh. We had, well, everything just shut down. We had, you know, book signings and launches and things all laid on, but of course, everything was cancelled. So basically, yeah, it was not the best time to try and launch a book. So I'm hoping that, you know, we can do a relaunch in the future sometime. And what I really need is an agent. If anybody out there knows a literary agent, just get them to get in touch.
And so is there is it just book one, or is there going to be more books? Because my family likes series, so that's
this is a fairly chunky read, I have to say. It's a big book, but yeah, it is part one. I did think it was going to be a single volume, but I discovered I'd only got halfway through the story that I wanted to tell, and it had turned into a very chunky read. So I decided to, as in all good stories, it finished on a high, but with some little teasers, you know, for what's going to happen next.
Excellent.
All right.
Well, I think we've encountered enough agents, even some in the UK, that we can put you in touch with one. Yeah.
Oh, that'd be great.
I think so. Yeah. We've done shows on several books, so we'll fix you up. We'll get you.
See, I was very lucky when David and Charles contacted me to write books for them, because I never had that situation of, you know, writing a book and then kind of hawking it around or needing an agent to find me a publisher. I was really lucky. I had a ready-made publisher waiting for the books. But of course, David and Charles don't publish non-fiction or what passes for non-fiction. So I found myself a little bit high and dry. But anyway, we won't go into that too much.
does writing those books become an escape for you from your daily needlework? Or is it just another thing to do?
I don't need an escape from needlework. Okay. in fact, if something happens and I find for any reason I can't stitch for a few days, I begin to get very grumpy. It's something that even after all these years, the actual process of embroidering is still a huge pleasure. And relaxation, you know, I just love it. And if I can't stitch for a while, I'm very miserable. Obviously, you know, there are elements of work which are more work than delight. But that tends to be, you know, the boring parts, like having to cope with accounts and you know, do all those things that everybody has to do to look after a business and a studio and that sort of thing. But the actual process of stitching, you know, I just love it. And I try and do a little bit every day, even if I'm really busy with other things. And if ever I don't want to stitch, you know, that's when I'm seriously poorly. the writing of the Saxon Twins, it was a very different type of writing in a way to my other books, because although it did involve a lot of research, obviously on the historical side, all of my embroidery books obviously do have a lot of illustrations and that sort of thing, which binds the text together in many ways. So this was something completely different, but I could always sort of lead myself back on track, really, by looking at the actual events of history, because that was my framework for the whole story. Although, you know, there are elements which I've obviously had to second guess what actually happened, because, of course, the joy of reading Anglo-Saxon history in their own words, which we have in things like the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles, they would write down things which today we simply wouldn't believe, but they would write it down as if it was the actual truth, and they believed it. So they would say something like, a crucifix on the high altar spoke. Now, it wasn't that, they said it spoke, or, it spoke. That was to be believed. And the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles were a serious, piece of writing that were put together year by year by year to tell posterity what happened every year. And so they put these things down as being the actual fact of what happened. Now, I had to look at something like that and think, yeah, okay, well, they believed that it happened, but how in actual fact did it happen? Nobody knows that. Nobody will ever know that. So those are the little things that I could use to, facilitate my story and make my characters do something interesting.
Hmm. Right. Yeah.
Gotta read it. Okay. All right, right turn back to embroidery. Now, Beth, you've been the masterclass books. You've got a couple of those.
I have in front of me the embroidered landscape ones, and I'm looking at the squirrel now because I have lots of squirrels in my little neighborhood, and I feed them when I feed the birds. So these are beautiful books in that they have so much information in them. And that's, I just am enjoying looking through them. My friend might not be getting them back until after the holidays.
The Masterclass series actually came about because in the other books, which I call the inspirational series, there weren't actually any projects to do. And some people felt that it would be nice to have a little bit more hands-on, should we say, embroidery content. And so that's how the Masterclass series came along. And I started with flowers because I thought that was a good way to, introduce, if I can put it that way, the simplest or some of the simplest motifs. And then they progressed on through butterflies and then birds and then animals. I think then it was gardens and landscapes. So there's six altogether of them. They build into a nice little library.
Yeah. And I could see where if someone wanted to learn how to do your technique, because your technique is very unique from other embroideries, I think.
I think you're right, actually. I must admit I've never encountered anybody that does quite what I do.
No. And it gives them the foundation to, maybe, because I think people are afraid to just jump in and do their own work, but it gives them a place to maybe start, and then maybe jump from there.
Yeah, of course, as you say, it's the techniques are possibly unique now, but if we go back once again, take a bit of a jump back into history, the technique which I call opus plumarium, featherwork, because it lies smoothly like the feathers on a bird's body, that was in fact a well-known Anglo-Saxon technique of the period that I was writing about as well. It's a technique which, although now I think perhaps, may I say, because people have read my books and enjoy the technique, is in fact starting to have a little bit of a resurrection, but what I like about it, is that, as I always say, if you can pull a needle through the fabric and then push it back in and take a single straight stitch, basically you can do this type of work. It is as simple as that. Mostly it is nothing but straight stitches, and it's what you do with those stitches that counts, and whether you make them long, whether you make them short, whether you slope them in a single direction or do a different direction, how you merge them together, That, if you like, is the skill, but the actual stitch that you take could not be simpler. It's as simple as putting it into the fabric and pulling it out again.
I don't know. You make it, it's so beautiful. It's hard to believe it's just a single stitch. It just is. But obviously it is. I mean, when you look, you take a close up look at the images.
The technique of Opus Plumarium in many ways was the technique out of which things like long and short stitch and satin stitch grew. Over the centuries, those stitches developed to have kind of rules and regulations applied to them, which in many ways made them less flexible and certainly less expressive when it came to, natural history subjects in particular. Whereas if you go back to the early technique, to the Opus Plumarium, in a way, there were no rules. Opus Plumarium emerged from split stitch, which was arguably the very earliest type of silk work. And if you look at massed split stitch, you can see the way the light catches the silk and the colors change. The longer the stitch and the less it is split, the more effective the light is in bringing a piece of work to life. And so gradually, as I understand it, gradually the split stitch evolved into the Opus Plumarium, at which point it was very fluid. You know, there weren't too many, as I say, or if any, rules and regulations applied to it. And then, of course, as history progressed, things changed and the fashion changed, and much more regulated and regimented stitches became the norm, until you got to the point really where we think of the Georgian Victorian samplers, where you had to get those stitches exactly in a certain way. You had to take them in a certain way for them to be, in inverted commas, correct. But as I've always said, and I mentioned earlier, there is no right and wrong. There's just a different way of using your needle and thread.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah.
And that's where, that's where that the creativity getting beaten out of people. Got to do it just this way, and that's what the rules say, and immediately the creativity just gets shoved aside.
I know what you mean. I do indeed.
I watched the Piper Silk video that you did.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And interesting about the Piper Silk, and talk a little bit about that. But what really came out of that was an excellent insight into your technique and that understanding of light and how it plays off of the silk and how the stitches work. You really, when you say that's where the skill is, clearly it is, because there's just a life to the stitching. And in that video, just a simple design that you did, so much life. And when you moved it around and let the light come off at a different angles, it was really just captivating.
Yes, it is amazing. And, it's such a simple concept, that getting your stitches to refract the light in a certain way will change color and therefore will give a three-dimensional effect. But, once you've kind of got that in your head, all of a sudden everything drops into place. There's a technique which I use, which I call opposite angle stitching, in which you have to kind of think three-dimensionally. If I get you to picture, say, a leaf, which is turning over, folding over across itself, so that you're seeing both surfaces of the leaf, one going one way and then one folding under itself the other way. If you can use exactly the same colored thread for both halves, if you like, of that leaf, but because you're using it at an opposite angle to each other, you will get a completely different shade appearing. And then as the light changes, or as you walk around and the light appears different from wherever you are seeing the leaf, those colors will change. And after a while, you do begin to kind of think in this way, and I know from, you know, having had countless students work these techniques over the years, that, you know, they will suddenly say, oh my god, I've got it, you know, the concept suddenly, you know, the penny drops, and, you know, all of a sudden that's it, and they've got it, they've got the idea of the swinging of the stitches and that kind of thing. I mean, it does work in almost any thread that you happen to use. It works with good old stranded cotton, but best of all, of course, is the floss silk, which is what I use, and you mentioned pipers. I was very lucky to discover very early on, I think almost within a year or so of giving up the day job, during which period I was using stranded cotton, but I very soon wanted to use something like pure silk. And as I said, it wasn't readily available back in the early 80s. It seems strange to think that now, when there are so many, relatively so many producers, but it just was not to be had back then, not easily anyway. And I was very lucky to discover that pipers existed literally in the next little village, well, not village, the next town to where I was living, sort of about 15 miles away. Now, Sudbury in Suffolk, I'm in Bury St Edmunds in Suffolk. Sudbury was a centre of the silk trade for centuries. The Huguenots came over from the continent due to religious persecution and brought their silk looms and their weaving and indeed their silk with them. And many of them settled in and around Sudbury and Lavenham. So there was a basis of silk knowledge, so to speak, in those two towns. There was a gentleman called Mr. Piper who had worked for one of the big silk factories, silk weaving factories, for many years. And when he retired, he decided that he would continue privately to import beautiful silks and to spin them off into small amounts, small cops, which he could sell for embroiderers and lace makers, you know, various different silk users. It was used also for fly tying, for fishing, you know, it's so fine and beautiful. And I now can't even remember how I discovered him, but he had all these beautiful silks and he simply ran his little business out of the garage at the back of his house.
Oh, my.
I know. And I remember going round with my daddy, in fact, bless him, because he was one of my, you know, he was so keen on everything that I was doing. And I told him, you know, I've discovered this. Oh, he said, I'm coming with you. and he and Mr. Piper were pretty much of an age, you know, they were retired gentlemen. They hit it off extremely well. Mr. Piper had built literally engineered from nothing a machine to spin this incredibly fine silk off the huge cops of silk, which were, you know, hundreds, thousands of meters long. They called them cheeses, those great huge cops of silk. And he had built this wonderful spinning machine to spin them onto reasonable sized cups. Well, of course, he and my father, that was it. They were offered looking at these machines, and I was left basically to rummage amongst this treasure in the garage, box upon box of gorgeous silk. And after that, I virtually never looked back. Of course, it did my artwork a huge service. I mean, it leapt instantly from something which, you know, the technique was good. Although, of course, in those days, my technique, I'd hardly even started exploring my technique. But, you know, from going from something which was, oh, yeah, that's quite nice, to something, oh my gosh, look at the effect of that, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was a huge step for me. When dear Mr. Piper passed away many years later, his daughter, Sue, who is a lovely, lovely person, took over the business. And it is still going under the name of Piper's Silks. And you can, there's a link on my website to Piper's Silks. I think there is. I'm not sure if I've built that page yet, actually. anyway, I've given it to you, Gary, I think, on one of the slides. So people will be able to take it, or you'll perhaps be kind enough to make sure we mention what it is. And, you know, it's wonderful. It's now, she now sells internationally. Overseas, she'll send anywhere in the world. She's got a fantastic website with all the shades of silk on it. And because I was working in Piper's Silks when I was working some of my early pictures for Inspirations now actually carries her silk, you know. So we've all now worked together. It's like a family. And yeah, it's beautiful silk. It's very fine. And if you saw the video, Gary, I think you probably remember hearing me say that I use three strands together, which in fact creates a strand roughly the gauge of a single strand of good old Anchor or DMC stranded cotton. So I always say use that dimension, that gauge, as your key dimension, so to speak, your control. And then from there you can split it down, or at least with this silk, of course, you don't have to split. You just simply use two strands for a finer effect. Then you can go down to one strand for an even finer effect. And then there's also what's come to be called Helen's Whisker Silk, which is actually incredibly fine. It's about like a, well, I won't say it's quite like a human hair, but it's not far off. And so if you want to work things like, you know, some of my subjects include spider's webs and you know, the antennae on butterflies and that sort of thing, you really can get down to absolute the minutiae of nature using some of those really, really fine ones.
Yeah, that talks about a relationship, a long relationship, when you can go to a distributor and you don't have to give numbers or anything. You just say, I need Helen's Whiskers thread, and we're good to go. Yeah,
yeah, that's it. Yeah, you want Helen's Whisker Silk in either black or white.
So it's impressive to me that a company like Piper's, you're still using it, I assume almost exclusively, through so many years, to keep the quality at the top level, impressive.
Yeah, I mean, not only is the quality of silk as good as it has ever been, there is now a greater choice of colors than there ever were. I off the top of my head, I can't tell you exactly how many, but it's in three figures, well into three figures of different shades and colours that they have. And of course, the joy is, because it is so fine, you can actually mix mix the shades in your needle just as if you were mixing paint.
Mm-hmm.
So if you wanted to create, you've got a green, but you want it to be a more yellowy green, you can simply use two strands of the green, add one of the yellow, and you've got an absolutely bespoke shade, you know. It's extraordinary, really, the effects you can get. Well, you've seen them. It's marvelous. And the other thing which I find amazing still is that I've seen pieces of work that I made 40 years ago with Piper's Silk, and it is bright and as vibrant now as the day I stitched it. Obviously, people, you know, they look after silk. You don't hang it directly in the sunlight or over a radiator or anything like that. But if you take just a little bit of care and, you know, make sure you keep it under just normal conditions, I would say, the colours just remain as bright and as shiny as they ever were.
And that's quite the testimony to that silk then, you know.
It is. Of course, I also think it's important. I always recommend that, once a piece of artwork is complete, that it is put behind glass, basically, because dust is the enemy of embroidery. I always remember it was when I was in Australia on a lecture tour over there, we went to see a collection of embroideries by a very well-known textile artist. I won't go into names, but very well-known. And her work was beautiful. It was a lot of insect subjects, big studies, sort of almost like murals and very, very big and almost three-dimensional in fact, not in effect, but in fact. And I always remember hearing somebody say, I saw that particular piece at an exhibition 15 years ago, and it looked so much better then. It's dull now.
Yeah.
And it was just, you know, the accumulation of 15 years worth of dust. And I don't care how clean you keep your house. You know, dust attaches to textile. It's just a fact of life, you know. So I always advise people with any textile, if it's flat enough, to get it behind glass, have a window mount in there so that your glass is not actually touching the silk, obviously, but get it safe, get it away, you know, from the atmosphere.
Before we run out of time, 20 years of contributions to Inspirations Magazine. What a partnership. Wow.
Yeah. Well, they're a great company to work with. And really looking forward. I've got a couple more projects for them in the pipeline at the moment. And it's great. But I mean, never mind 20 years. I can't believe that I've been stitching for so long, even before that. Where did those years go?
When they come to you for a contribution, do they come to you, or do you just are you at a point now where you just offer them?
They come to me. I don't ever not have anything to do, put it that way. I've still, you know, I've always got something on the go for somebody. I don't think I've ever actually had to go out and hustle for work. Obviously they know how long it takes to create some pieces of work. And so they don't sort of say, oh, you know, can we have it in a couple of months' time? they obviously plan their issues 2 years ahead very often, you know, so the deadline for actually getting work complete for them is usually, you know, a very sensible distance away from when we start talking about it.
Do we make an extra effort for them when a project comes up? I mean, do you feel a little extra pressure to?
No. I mean, when I, you know, the first project I did for them, and maybe the second as well, you know, I felt, because again, that was quite a long time ago, I maybe felt very slightly, you know, daunted at the thought of working for such a prestigious magazine. But, you know, now, as I say, we feel like family. So, no, I always create what, you know, I think a client wants. But very, very rarely is that not what I want as well. So, you know, it evens out. It evens out. No, it's a great relationship.
Yeah. You've been very fortunate with your books and with your inspiration contributions to have excellent publishing houses behind them. I think people don't appreciate how important that is.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And also, I feel privileged that certainly when I was writing my what I call my big books for David and Charles, it was in the era before a lot of digital photography and scanning. Scans are good, don't get me wrong, you know, they're effective, but sometimes, you know, you can't improve upon setting a picture up and doing an old-fashioned piece of photography with getting the lights in the right place to throw that silk into, you know, into relief. And all of the photographs in my books are actually, you know, photographs as opposed to scans. So we would set each picture up and make sure that the angle of the stitching, you know, related to where the light was shining from. And it was a big project each time for the books. Of course, I don't have to get involved with that as far as the magazine work is concerned, because they have their own in-house photographers to do all that. But you are right. I you know, I have been fortunate to work with, I think, the best. Yeah.
So do you send your finished pieces then to Australia when they?
Yeah, it's scary. It is scary.
I was going to say.
we very nearly had a major disaster during the pandemic when, of course, everything was, you know, nothing was working as it should be for obvious reasons, you know. And I sent the picture, which actually is, I think, in the current issue at the moment. It's the picture that's in the Christmas issue of Inspirations, which is out at the moment, which is of a Victoria, Australian Victoria crowned pigeon, beautiful big sort of gorgeous, colourful bird. And it was a big embroidery. And of course, yes, it had to be packed up and sent over there. And I always, for things like that, you know, spend the money and send it international express or whatever. And, you know, it should have been with them in I think it was 5 to 7 days. And like it was 6 weeks later and Ooh. We were beginning to be a bit desperate, shall we say. But all's well that ends well anyway. And yeah, cut a long story short, they got it in the end. But yeah, that was a bit hairy that time.
Ooh. Yes. Yeah. Yes. All right. Mailing anything now, you know.
Yeah, no, things are gradually getting back to normal now, thank goodness. But no, it was a difficult time, I think, for all of us during the pandemic, wasn't it?
Yeah. All right, yeah. We need to wrap up. But to wrap up, we got to hear about your 2023 calendar. Is this an annual thing?
Oh, well, yes, it has been for the last few years that I create 12 pictures, especially for a calendar. So they're pictures that haven't been seen anywhere else before, except I sometimes put a little sneaky detail on my Facebook page and that sort of thing. But basically, the pictures themselves are new. You know, they haven't been published anywhere else. The 2023 calendar is available at the moment. If you go straight onto the home page of my website, which is helenmstevens.online. You'll come onto the home page and you'll see that there's a place you can click through straight from there. It says calendar available now, and it will take you through and give you all the details. And they're quite a lot have already gone out. You're kind of still in time for Christmas, always assuming the post behaves itself. The theme this year, I try and pick a different theme every year. The theme this year is including a detailed decorative border around each picture, sort of reflecting the time of the year and the passing seasons. I don't actually produce patterns for each of the pictures or anything like that. It is basically a pictorial calendar, obviously with the date page as well. But I do always say, if people want to trace off any part of the calendar and make their own template like that, then, you know, I'm perfectly happy for them to do so. And as far as techniques are concerned, of course, they can learn how I've done it by either my books or my videos any of the other ways of understanding my work. So, there we go. Yeah, I can't believe that we're nearly into 2023 already. It seems crazy.
Yeah, it certainly does. Well, all right. So that's a great gift there. So people can hunt that down at your website. It's Helen M. Stevens with an S on the end, .online, and get calendars for your stitching friends, because, it looks beautiful. Just the pictures on your website, it looks like a beautiful thing. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Good
Thank
for you.
You. Yes, it's. I think they do get a little bit more exotic every year.
Yep, why not?
And again, very nice photography, from somebody who kind of knows what they're doing. So, yeah, it's produced entirely on recycled paper with natural dyes. And, we make quite sure that it does no harm to the environment. So we just always try and make sure people know that.
Yep. Helen, an absolute treat talking with you. Thanks so much for making the time. Really fun.
Lovely. I've really enjoyed it, Gary, and nice to chat to you, Beth, as well.
Yeah, thank you so much for the time. It has been wonderful. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
And we got Gary to spend some money, which is always fun.
Oh, that's always good. Yeah, yeah.
All right. Thanks, Helen, and thanks to everyone for listening.